we are compelled and we are entitled to know in alternation. Let us then take up this gradation of our knowledge seriously. If you can leave this college with this knowledge, when you are allowed to know of God's presence, the rare moments, when you are allowed to know of your humanity, and when you are allowed of your sociological conditioning, of your psychological reactions, and of your chemical or biological tests, then you have already learned a lot. But you must reverse the gradation of knowledge. The natural knowledge of yourself is the cheapest because the most general knowledge. The knowledge of your place, your role, your decision in the history of the human race is the most important, the rarest, the most risky knowledge. It's just the other way around as people try to teach you. The real question of sociology is not how many people buy Cadillacs and how many people buy Fords. The real question of sociology, for example, would be, how long do I belong to my own society? Sociology, after all, has to do with the membership in groups. Why don't they ask this question? How long can a decent person say that he is able, as a living, growing creature, to belong to any one group? Am I still able to remain an American? Do I have to defy this country and say that I am more than an American, that I am a human being? I told you already that I hope you will not be faced by this issue. You may be spared. But all the people in Europe have been visited by this very question. There's no Chinaman who didn't have to decide whether he still was a Chinaman, because is communist China the same? I got a New Year congratulation 20 years ago from a Chinese gentleman. He had painted it himself, he had written it himself. As you know, they treat writing as an art. And it had this one burden that returned throughout the poem. There's not even a chance for tears. There's not even a chance for tears. The China of the 4,000 years is gone. This means that this man said that 600 million Chinese, you see, had lost their belonging, that they had now the right not only, but were under the compulsion to find a new allegiance. Ask my dear friend, the professor of Chinese in this college, how it feels to come to a country in which he never will be fully recognized as an American, and his children will not, and yet he has to love this country, and he does more for this country than many people who allegedly came over with the Mayflower. These, my friends, are wonderful people. And you laugh off this great problem of his self-knowledge, that one day he had to say to himself, I no longer am a Chinese. But there you see that the real sociology of the human society is not a question of questionnaires. Because a questionnaire is something you can ask a person anytime. And a real question is a question which you cannot dare to ask this man arbitrarily. Only in a grave and friendly intimacy can you speak to him about this permanent pain, this tremendous change in his lifetime. The same is true of the family. I have attended a class on family relations in which the rule was laid down that nobody was allowed to bring in any one experience about his own family in order to keep the treatment on an objective level. This man, of course, graded his sociology down. He limited it to a natural science of unimportant facts outside of the time element. And so physics, anatomy, chemistry, physiology, psychology, sociology, politics, and divinity are graded by the amount of availability. The truth is not available in the same manner in all these fields. and the importance decreases when the availability increases. I think I already told you the story of the chaplain and his group on religion, where he said he now had 100 students every Sunday evening for a discussion of religion, and before he had only 20, and wasn't this showing an increasing interest in religion? So we asked him, did the 100 people know any more about religion than the 20? And he said, no, of course not. Now, I do not think that 100 people talking in an unimportant and inexperienced manner of religion are anything more valuable than 20 people who know nothing about the same subject. 100 times zero is still zero. A detective story, and all the things that, so to speak, imitate the Bible or the history books or the biographies of great men, these detective stories are available all the time, but they reduce life then to mathematics, to a kind of riddle with A, B, C, and X. And if you have X on one side and the known factors on the other, you can solve the riddle of the detective story. But it is a reduction of reality to mere mathematics, and that's why I cannot read detective stories, and I am told that most people cannot read any detective story more than once, because once they know the answer, it is uninteresting. Now, any good book, you can read any amount of time. Now you may ask me, that's rather discomforting. We are here in college, wasting our time. We aren't faced with any great decision. We, after all, are before these great decisions. So how do we fill our time? Well, the wisdom of such an educational process as a liberal arts college is quite profound. You cannot know how you will act in the end. One boy said to me, never shall I be despondent. Suicide is out of the question. Well, this boy, of course, is a fool. He will be the first to be despondent 10 years from now. Never say never about anything in your own life. We don't know ourselves. But something we can know once you throw out the notion that you read literature for entertainment. Great literature, gentlemen, is not like the detective story. And here is the last comfort I want to leave with you. If this grading of knowledge is true, we have to wait for much self-knowledge. We are only free to wait in shame, in discretion, but you can fill this preparation, this preliminary chapter of your life by reading and participating in great literature. This is not a luxury. This is not a detective story to be bought on the spot. But that is a preparation for the magnitude of your own decision. Every piece of literature which is worth reading enhances your generosity, your plasticity, your flexibility. It makes you bigger than you have been before. Read Othello for entertainment, and it is nothing. But Othello makes you, in fact, see how black your heart is, and any heart is. His skin is black, but your heart is black, because you all are jealous, and jealousy seems to be the one disease in America in which, especially the women folks, indulge as though it was not perhaps criminal or a sin. They all say to be jealous is a privilege. Read Othello. Then you will have be prepared for treating jealousy without a dagger at the right moment. You will be able to rise above jealousy, as every one of us has, not only in his marital relations, but in his relations of friendship, in his relations in politics. Jealousy has to be put into its place. So when you read Othello, you are, by poetry, prepared to meet this truth outside your own lifetime. The miracle of poetry is that it is encountering you, and you are encountering it outside real time. And therefore, it is not destructive to your self-knowledge. When you read poetry, it doesn't come too early in your own life because it doesn't enter your real life. that remains fancy. Poetry, therefore, is protecting you against the shamelessness of your own soul, because although the whole issue is there, right before you, it is in the disguise of another man's or another woman's life. It is your own life in anticipation, transparent, but transposed under the name of Othello or Hamlet or Macbeth. And that is why this play doesn't hurt your freedom of decision. And that must be the deepest reason why Shakespeare has introduced now, well, 16 generations of people, or 15 generations of people, to their own lives in an era in which science destroyed the notion of men for the rarity of self-knowledge, for this momentous fact that we know only in rare moments what we have to know about ourselves. You store up powers of discretion and of decision by reading poetry. Poetry has always to deal with your future. And I'm already able to know what I positively cannot know about myself. In this very strange garment woven as a dream about the future. If you wanted to know the same truth which the poet offers you in the form of an ethical code, in the form of a lecture on morality, without this poetic veil, you would become a solemn ass. It is asinine to study a course of ethics in advance. No situation which you will have to meet will ever have anything to do with all the abstract notions and sentences and phrases which you have picked up in the process of learning about yourself directly. But it is very different when you have read Goethe's Werther, or Moby Dick, or Pierre, and then become despondent. Your despondency will be illuminated. You can strengthen and fortify your heart in this simile. And therefore, gentlemen, poetry is a voluntary veil around the future. And in this, it equals your dress, it equals the discretion and the shamefulness and bashfulness of your in your side, your own group, and its intimacy with regard to that which is still to come, which is anticipated and which as yet has not found any expression by the social setup of a home or of a friendship or of a roommate or any such privacy. Poetry then is the ritual which corresponds to the wedding gown of the bride. Ritual is inherited form, but poetry is the invention of your own free future, and therefore you need it. And the good college can do for you is to make you not appreciate art that would still leave this art outside of your own way of life, but to bring this art in such a place in your life that its stars enlighten the night of your heart at a decisive moment. All art invents your own future possibilities. And what has been poetry 500 years ago usually becomes reality 500 years later. The wedding gown and the bridal veil around your shameful soul's most secret growth. That is poetry. And this perhaps solves our whole course which we have taken here into some understandable solution. We will have to walk in frankness thanks to poetry, but not in nakedness.